I am John Dickerson. I'm a, I guess, third year assistant professor at the University of Maryland in right up the street in College Park. And today I'll be talking about an introduction, briefly introducing the audience to algorithms, AI, and predictive analytics. And so for this talk, I'd like to start with a motivational quote, which sounds like it was written a long time ago, and that's because it was. So although machines can perform certain things as well or perhaps better than any of us can, they infallibly fall short in others. By which means we may deduce that they did not act from knowledge, but only from the disposition of their organs. And this sounds old because it was written a long time ago. It was written by Descartes, who was a philosopher and mathematician in the 1600s. So quite a long time ago, folks were already thinking about what does it mean to think? Can we mechanize thought? Another famous philosopher from the 1600s, Hobbes, states reasoning is nothing but reckoning. So reckoning here is just a reference to mathematics. So reasoning is nothing but mathematics, essentially. And so some time passed, 1600s, 1700s, 1800s, and so the 1900s, when some breakthroughs occurred in logic and mathematics and philosophy, folks like Boole, folks like Hilbert, made some breakthroughs in the formalizations of mathematical reasoning. So recall, we think reasoning is nothing but reckoning, and now we can reckon, perhaps, with mathematics. So there were some proofs showing that some hard limits, there are some hard limits to what mathematical reasoning can do. But subject to those limits, folks like Alan Turing came around, Church came around and said there are certain machines, simple machines, that for any of these mathematical reasoning problems, subject to these limits, we can create a machine that can do this. So this is nice. This builds on now hundreds of years of philosophy and mathematics. But the general pitch here is that if intelligence can be simulated by mathematical reasoning, that is, reasoning is just reckoning, and mathematical reasoning can be simulated by a machine, then can a machine simulate intelligence? So AI, artificial intelligence, the word was coined by John McCarthy in either 1955 or 1956, depending on how you count, 55 in a proposal to fund the Dartmouth Summer Research Project on Artificial Intelligence. And you'll hear this called the Dartmouth Conference. This occurred in the summer of 1956. And there are some fun quotes in there saying basically we can solve artificial intelligence in 3 months or we can solve artificial intelligence in one generation. But the one I'd like to pull out is that every aspect of learning or any other feature of intelligence can be so precisely described that a machine can be made to simulate it. So even in the 1950s, 1960s, folks were making statements like this. So a quick spoiler, this hasn't happened yet. We can just shut this down right now. But progress has been made. So how does that progress occur? Well, this is a cycle of basically R&D progress that you'll see repeating in the AI world, and this has happened since basically 1956, where some new advance, maybe a new technique, new hardware, happens. Fast progress is then made on old hard problems. So it could be a new mathematical technique, it could be new hardware. GPUs, these graphics processing units, are one of the main drivers in the current sort of fast progress being made on old hard problems that we're seeing now. But eventually, you start to hit roadblocks. And at this point, the academic community, the industrial community, starts to get pessimistic. This bleeds into the press. And at that point, everyone is pessimistic about progress. Funding dries up. Progress dries up, and so on. We wait until the next large advance. And so this is a cycle that occurs in most sort of verticals. It occurs in AI research as well. In AI, though, we call it a cycle of basically AI summers and AI winters. The winters are when funding dries up and nothing happens. The summers are basically what we're going through right now, where we're seeing large advances driven by sort of recent hardware and mathematical advances. So this is a bit pessimistic, this cycle, but like I said, progress has been made. So this has been cycling for arguably maybe 6 or 7 times since the 1950s, but every time we go through this loop, progress is made. New problems are solved and new problems are encountered. So what is AI? AI, many definitions, the one I'll use here, is the ability to process and act based on information via automation. So we can break this down roughly into 4 segments. One is perception. I want to be able to perceive the world around me. That could be the physical world, that could be the virtual world. I want to be able to learn something about it. So I get some signals about the world, then I learn something about it. Maybe I learn a model. I want to abstract and generalize that model so that I can use it in other situations. And what do I mean by use? Well, maybe I can reason about this information, I can reason using my model, and then act within the world. Again, that could be virtual, that could be physical. So if I can create this automated system, roughly, I have created what we would call AI. So let's keep moving through this history of AI until we are where we are today. Roughly, we can split AI research into some first wave AI, second wave AI, and then maybe 2.5 or third wave, which is where we are right now. In this first wave, primarily, researchers focused on what is called search. So this is either searching through a potential solution space. Quick examples, chess is a good example here, where we had, say, Deep Blue beating Kasparov via a sophisticated algorithm that did search through using domain-specific heuristics, expert knowledge, for instance. Folks who've played a lot of chess encoded heuristics into the search algorithm. It would search through the solution space to find, say, the next move to play. Now, another hallmark of first wave AI is something called expert systems. And this also relies on basically bringing in a lot of expert knowledge to form some sort of large database of rules, of knowledge, of facts about the world, using some sort of inference engine, typically based on logical reasoning, to make new sort of conclusions based on these facts, and then some sort of action IO system to interact with the human. So this is basically the world up until maybe the 80s in terms of AI. Now, there were some large successes here. So one example that I used earlier is this chess champion falling to basically a sophisticated search algorithm. And there are many more. And in fact, techniques from first wave AI are still used in practice. But they're decidedly brittle, and they really don't have any real learning capability. So they're really sort of a function of just the knowledge that you encode into them. There's a huge overhead to encoding that knowledge. Right, I have to ask, say, every member of the audience and everyone watching to tell me all the facts that they know about the world, and then I have to store that somehow. And that might be brittle, that might not be generalizable. They're very, very brittle systems, but they do allow me to do in-depth specific reasoning. Right, if I ask a bunch of experts for facts on a specific vertical, then I can do a lot of fast automated reasoning about just that vertical. So that can be good, but it's very difficult to generalize. And if you recall back to that earlier slide, we want generalizability, we want abstraction, because we want to create some system that's able to encounter new environments and still act in a reasonable way. So, in terms of those four boxes, first wave AI generally does perception reasonably well in the sense that I've asked all audience members to give me facts, and it can do reasoning and acting reasonably well, but it won't learn and it won't generalize. Now, there were some transition points in multiple areas of sort of AI research. One of these is something called natural language processing, which says, can I get a computer to ingest, say, raw text? Or can I get Alexa to ingest signal from your voice and then have it understand that in some sense? So in natural language processing, up until about the late 1980s, most of the rules for doing this sort of translation or understanding were done via hard-coded sort of expert rules. Around the late 80s, probabilistic models started to come into play. Okay, so this is going to sound more like machine learning, like folks have maybe heard about in the press. These are models that ingest, in this case, large text corpora and learn patterns in that data. To look at a different vertical in AI, so autonomous vehicles rely heavily on something called computational vision, which says, hey, I have a video image. Can I understand what's going on in that image? Say I'm a car and I'm driving along and I have a still image of the road in front of me, can I understand that there's a stop sign and a pedestrian and a dog in front of me and so on? So in autonomous vehicles, in the mid-2000s, DARPA ran what they call a grand challenge, in fact, their first grand challenge, which asked, can I create a vehicle that can drive some 100 plus miles across the desert autonomously? In 2004, no vehicles completed this task. In fact, I think the longest trip that a vehicle took was something like 10 miles. And these vehicles relied heavily on hand-coded rules that say something like, in general, when you're, you know, 10 degrees away from the sun and you're driving forward at a particular speed, then a shadow is going to be a shadow instead of a rock with some set of features associated with it. And again, this is a very brittle system. This is not going to generalize very well. But then in 2005, five teams completed the entire trip, so 100 plus miles. And this is because they started using these probabilistic models. And in fact, you can see the general manager for the program, Strat, at the time, had a fun quote. Vehicles were scared of their own shadows, hallucinating obstacles when they weren't there. And this is for those prior systems. And then probabilistic models allowed them to get around this. So you can see similar transition points throughout all core AI areas in the late 80s, in the 90s, up and through basically the mid-2000s. And this happened because of three things. One is computational power increased. And this is the story of basically computation since the 40s or 50s. This has played a driving role in AI development as well. Number two, storage costs decrease. I don't have to pay a lot of money to store a lot of data. And three, everyone in this world now relies on statistical models. Maybe with some expert input, but still statistical models. So this takes us into the second wave of AI. And there's no hard date for this because it happened differently in different verticals in this world. Here, we're relying on this assumption now that we've learned the hard way multiple times that encoding all knowledge explicitly does not work. It doesn't scale. It's very brittle. And it's very difficult to handle uncertainty. The new idea is that we should create a general statistical model for a problem domain. We should create a statistical model for natural language, or for a type of natural language, or for autonomous driving, a type of autonomous driving. What do we do with that model? Well, we feed in data from the real world, or maybe simulated data, until it looks right. And this is going to be characterized by statistical learning. So the reason why these models have taken off is because if we input a different data set, or say set of data sets, into these models, we'll learn a different model, and then we can deploy that in a different environment. So it's much more generalizable. Now, some examples. In machine translation, for instance, going back to this natural language that we discussed earlier, we can feed in multilingual text corpora to learn relationships between language. So say we want to translate French to English. One of the early multilingual text corpora came from Canada, where there are rules stating that, say, any government ruling has to appear both in English and French. And so now we have a mapping between English and French documents. We can feed that into a model, and we can learn a way to translate between the two systems. Autonomous vehicles. We can feed in videos and tests of successful driving into a model, and then learn what scenarios are safe or not safe, or maybe put some error bars around what scenarios are safe in general. Face detection, face recognition. I can feed in many labeled faces of people. Here is where the face is, or here is where the face is, and an ID associated with that, to learn what a face looks like, or to learn what, say, your face looks like. So these types of models are very good at perception, and they're very good at learning. Remember, we're training these models, these general models, based on a data set, and if we feed in a different data set, we're going to get a different result. So they're reasonably good at abstraction and generalization as well, so long as your model is general enough, and so long as you have enough data. But there is no reasoning or acting. I've made no statements about, say, when one should turn the car in the turn the wheel in the autonomous vehicle. So, a quick example model. Remember, these are systems that rely on statistical learning to train probabilistic models that will tell us something about the world. A quick example is a neural network. So these appear a lot in the news now, which is why I've chosen them. But they're not a new idea. Indeed, that 1955 proposal where McCarthy defined AI, used the term AI for the first time, also discusses neural networks. I believe they were called neuron networks at the time. So this is not a new idea. The general idea of neural networks is that one should pass information into this input layer, which you see on the left side of the screen. So that information could be pixels of an image. That information could be something with audio signal. It will cascade through the network along basically a series of pipes that go through nodes. And these pipes have, say, different widths that can be controlled by a learning algorithm. And then the final layer of this network that has information flowing through it will create some sort of guess. In the case of, say, classifying images, here we have cats and dogs, it's going to create, say, a probabilistic model of whether or not an image is a cat or a dog. And that gives you some signal as to how good or bad your statistical model, in this case a neural network, is acting. A very general model, so long as we can feed information into it via that input layer, and so long as we can judge the output, and so long as we can actually learn, so make the network better using sophisticated optimization techniques, We can use this for many problems, and indeed, that is what we've seen. So long as we can, again, train these models through repetitive sort of optimization algorithms. So another sort of buzzword that one sees in the press a lot is a deep neural network. Again, not a new idea. These existed, I think, since the 1980s. And they're just these neural networks that we had on the last slide, but with more, quote unquote, hidden layers. These are the layers in between that input and that output. So I can add more and more of these. I can create more piping, intricate piping between these different nodes to learn new patterns in the data. And sometimes, indeed, we can stack many, 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 many more nodes. So order of hundreds of thousands, millions, et cetera. So these are very large models. And again, this is because we have increased computational power and cheap storage. That idea for deep networks has existed since the 80s, but we've seen them taking off in the last 5 to 10 years because of advances in hardware, because of a huge increase in the amount of data that exists. So we have large firms collecting data, we have the government collecting data, and we can now store it cheaply, access it quickly. And because, indeed, from the R&D community, there have been much better methods developed for learning basically how to make a good one of these. They're hugely successful. They're good at detecting anomalies in data, for instance, credit card fraud. They're good at voice recognition. You've seen Alexa, Siri, Google Assistant, et cetera. They're great at machine translation, language generation, game playing. Some recent high-profile success stories such as AlphaGo playing basically expert level Go, DeepStack playing expert level heads-up poker. Self-driving cars are starting to take off. Video search, audio search, finance, et cetera. These are all success stories in part due to deep learning. Not a new idea, driven by advances in hardware and training, though. Nobody understands why they work very well. And this is a common story in AI as well, and this is something that we're seeing more and more appearing, which is humans have sat down, they've designed the network structure, they've designed what those nodes and what those connections between the nodes look like. Maybe they're encoding some domain expertise. There are some known heuristics that you can rely on. There's a trial and error process, and maybe actually other AI is actually coming in and trying to train these models or structure these models in a better way. But nobody knows when or why they don't work in general. So they work well in expectation, which is why we see machine translation systems, which is why we see Alexa and Siri in households now. But when they fail, it can be very confusing, it can be reasonably catastrophic, and it can be very hard to explain. And some recent research pushes, funded by the DoD, funded by industry, funded by nonprofits, have started noticing that, hey, an adversary can exploit this kind of behavior. When I have a system I trust most of the time, but it can be exploited in very odd ways, and I don't understand why or why, when that happens, then I can wreak some havoc in these systems. So I'd like to take a step back. So now we've talked about deep learning, we've talked about machine learning, we've talked about AI, and roughly, AI is this sort of four-pillar approach to perceiving the world, learning about it, building an abstract and general model, and then using that to act and reason. Machine learning is just one way to build these models, where we do not focus on acting and reasoning, but we focus on perception, on learning, on abstraction, and on generalization. And deep learning is just a specific form of basically representational learning, so it's a type of machine learning. Okay, so every time you hear deep learning in the news, you can replace it with machine learning mentally. It's just a way to solve a machine learning problem. So some present-day movements in AI, understanding bias and methods for debiasing. You'll hear about this, I think, throughout today and tomorrow, many of the topics on this slide. So this is sort of a teaser. Understanding bias and methods for debiasing. So if I feed skewed training data into these systems, remember these are statistical models that are trained on data from somewhere in the world. If I feed skewed data into the system, then I'm going to learn something that represents that skewed data. So how do we understand when that happens? And can we create systems that still feed in this biased data, which might be the only data that exists, but spits out a model that is debiased? As mentioned before, adversarial reasoning and multi-agent systems, learning to act with cooperative actors, learning to act with adversarial actors. So bringing in older fields such as game theory into these new methods for solving those problems. How do I, say, design, well, I'll talk about this in a few slides, but how do I design policies as a firm to compete with other, say, firms that are both cooperative and adversarial? Can I do this based on machine learning? Also mentioned on the previous slide, robustness to noise, robustness to adversarial attacks, both in terms of theoretical robustness and empirical robustness. How do I design automated systems that fail less, that are robust to attacks, and that fail more predictably? Because obviously these systems will always fail at some point. And in that vein, explainable AI, there's a lot of money going into this as well, because it's very difficult to interpret the results that come out of these systems from time to time. So can we produce human understandable models that also work well? And one final move in the AI community has been reinforcement learning. It's a type of machine learning, but it's a type of machine learning that also focuses on learning to act and reason. So now we're getting closer to that initial definition of artificial intelligence. Here we have an agent, maybe physical, maybe virtual, that's going to act within an environment. It's going to receive a reward signal and then maximize total reward. It wants to find the actions to take for any state in the world, such that when it takes that action, it is treated well in the future. It receives reward and expectation in the future. And I'll give you some examples of this at the end of the talk. So here again, reinforcement learning, not a new idea. But deep networks have been used extensively here to revolutionize their use in practice. So here we have deep networks that are used to, say, reduce the complexity of representing the environment. Remember, I can't actually write everything down. I don't want to represent every single fact in my computer, so now I'm going to learn some abstraction of the world, and then act on that. So reinforcement learning is taking us closer to what we want to call AI. We have perception, we have learning. These are just like machine learning. We have abstraction and generalization, again, moving toward that. Again, if we train these models on different data, we get a different trained model, and we're starting to move toward reasoning and acting here. So in the context of this audience, I thought I would do maybe a quick deep dive into a few uses of AI, particularly in something called market design. So markets provide agents the opportunity to gain from trade. Many markets require structure to operate efficiently. Market design is going to tackle this problem via what's called economic engineering. So I put on my economist hat, and I put on my engineer's hat, and I put on my mathematician's hat. I'm wearing three hats at this point, but I can use these hats to design a market. How do I structure the market? How do I constrain the market such that I achieve some sort of efficiency goals? AI is increasingly helping with the design of these markets. For instance, these automated methods can use data to help designers characterize families of market structures. They can be used, obviously, for predictive methods that anticipate, say, future supply and demand in electricity markets or finance markets. One example, as a computer scientist, this is close to my heart because a lot of the money in our world comes from this, is using AI in online advertising. So online advertising markets generally match advertisers with consumers. Many billions of dollars, and this is an increasing market, many, many billions of dollars are being used here, and it's a driving force in the technology sector. Machine learning models in this space right now are being used to divide customers into very fine-grained and automatically generated segments. So no longer just male, female, but something far, far more fine-grained than that. That's learned automatically. They're being used to set reserve prices and auctions based on user modeling and bidder behavior, again, automatically. They're being used to automatically generate the creatives, that is the artwork that you see pop up on your screen, automatically generate those, say without human input, to fit a specific customer's predicted wants. All automated. Reinforcement learning-based tools, remember this is that form of machine learning that also focuses a bit on acting, are being used to help advertisers, for instance, bid automatically on these very fine-grained segments. Remember, now we have, say, millions of segments. How do I bid on that? I can use a machine learning-based model to do this. Another example, AI and electricity markets. Here, matching supply and demand is extremely important. It relies heavily on demand forecasting. Machine learning-based techniques are going to provide very accurate demand forecasting, which leads to very stable market prices and more efficient power usage. Reinforcement learning-based techniques, remember ML, plus some form of acting, are going to allow us to activate or deactivate expensive, heterogeneous power sources to maintain that stability. So I can predict better demand. I can predict better demand at particular time points further into the future, and then I can make a plan to boot up or boot down particular power sources such that I maintain market stability, such that I reduce brownouts, and so on. Again, automated. And my final example is AI and kidney allocation. This is close to my heart. I've done a lot of work in this space. So here, kidney exchanges, for instance, are an organized market where patients with end-stage renal disease enter and are able to swap donors, willing living donors, to receive new organs. It's a really interesting paradigm that's been around for, say, 15 years now, and it accounts for something like 10, 11, 12, 13% now of all US living donations of kidneys. Hundreds of transplant centers are involved in this organized market, in fact, multiple organized markets. And here, AI-based tools are also operating. Now, this isn't fully automated, but they are, for instance, semi-automatically and optimally, subject to human value judgments, matching donors to patients, both in the US and also worldwide. Here I've called out the United Kingdom and the Netherlands, but in many countries. They're providing sensitivity analysis at a level that humans cannot for new policies. And they're learning from data the quality of, say, potential matches in this market. Now, let's return to some open questions and some recent pushes, which will, I guess, trigger good discussion for the rest of today and tomorrow. So one is, how and why does deep learning work? So I've mentioned, not a new idea. Neural networks existed since the 50s. Deep learning existed since the 80s. Now we have new hardware. Now we have new training techniques. These tend to work very well in expectation, but when they fail confusingly. Why do they work? How can we handle incentives of competing agents? All those three market examples that I showed you, firms are obviously going to compete against each other in this space. The government, regulatory agencies have their own incentives as well. Individual participants have their own incentives. How do we handle this? How do we encode other aspects, such as fairness, accountability, and transparency into these systems? How do I ensure that my automated system doesn't marginalize, say, an already marginalized class in the ever sort of increasing hunt for efficiency? How do I even define this? How do I define fairness? This is a classic question in economics that computer scientists are now starting to struggle with as well. How do I implement this in a scalable way, in an understandable way? Ethical AI, this will be talked about, I believe, later by folks like Henry Kautz. How do I divide the labor between policymakers, such as those in this audience, who are ethically trained and ethically minded, and technically trained, perhaps ethically neutral, AI and machine learning experts? So I can implement, say, a very sophisticated system, but I need to then produce some sort of aggregate output that I can pass back to policymakers to ensure that this is reflecting the aggregate human value judgments of those who control the systems. How do I do that? And there are close ties in this sort of exploration to the world of privacy and the world of social norms. So in general, our end goal is to create these systems that perceive the world, learn from it, create some sort of generalizable model, and then inevitably learn to act using that model. We're not quite there yet, but there's a lot of hope in this space. But I'm going to say that maybe this isn't even the biggest problem. The biggest problem is going to be the interplay between these systems and society, ethical issues, societal norms, human value judgments. How do we play between, say, these sort of sophisticated machine learning-based approaches to what I've shown here on this slide and the rest of the real world? So I'll leave it at that.